This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad, and it's the day before this year's Ontario budget comes down. So what are the priorities CARP is looking for? We already know the Ford PCs have put off balancing the books by a year. It was supposed to happen this year. Now they say next year. We'll see. There are reports the government is going to unveil significant auto insurance reforms, which are expected to broaden the range of options available to drivers by increasing, quote, optionality to reduce auto insurance costs. Now, this comes in the context of increased insurance premiums for all of us because of this epidemic of car theft. So whether your car is a desirable car target or not, it's up an average of $130 per driver. And all I can say to this optionality is you better make sure that you are covered if something happens. Otherwise, you could be stuck with a very large bill. And in another nod to cash-strapped consumers, as you heard in Bob's News, Ford is extending the temporary gas tax cut until the end of the year, and this as the federal carbon tax is set to kick in a week today. Also, what do they have planned for healthcare and recruiting and retaining staff? We just got a number on the hugely expensive use of agency nurses, and that bill has risen to nearly $1 billion. What are your priorities? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'm joined by Bill Van Gorder, Chief Operating Officer and Chief Policy Officer of CARP, Anthony Quinn, Chief Community Officer at CARP, and John Wright, Executive Vice President of Meru Public Opinion. Welcome, everyone.
Good afternoon, Libby.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. Hi, John.
Hello.
Okay. You're a little low there, John. Now, I'd like to start with Bill. So quickly, in a little laundry list, what is CARP looking for tomorrow?
Well, we're looking for a number of things, but the five major ones are better funding of home care, transforming long-term care, improving preventative health care, making vaccines more accessible, and drastically cutting wait times. It's a really important list.
Yeah, it sounds like a really expensive list, and I am sure that if you listen to the PC government, they'll say that they're doing all those things. They're doing brilliantly well, Anthony.
Well, the savings that home care offers the healthcare system is should be very apparent to anybody who's responsible for the budget. If you allow people to age in their own homes and supply the care they need to stay there, then they stay out of hospitals. And it's $100 a day for home care, and it's $1,000 a day in a hospital.
Well, yeah, except we've known that for a long time, and nothing changes. I mean, there are little drip drops of extra funding for it, and it's very difficult. I mean, I know lots of people, so they get home care, but the person doesn't come when they're supposed to come, doesn't stay as long as they're supposed to stay. Not necessarily their fault, but because they have a long list of people to get to, and it's very hard to keep and attract people. John Wright, where does this concern rank in terms of what people are thinking about and worried about now?
Well, in terms of home care and, you know, healthcare is the top of the list with affordability. So the real question here is, where is it going to fall within a budget? And what the Ford government's doing is really putting affordability in the window as opposed to the issues that have just been rhymed off. I mean, those are important issues for people who are affected by them and by their families and by the long-term context of it. But I think, again, governments nowadays deal with the number one issue, and that is how much can you afford to live nowadays? How can you save money? And what can you do to alleviate the tax burden on people if it's going to help them spend money more effectively?
So let's get to what they're planning to do. Now, first of all, the extension of that temporary 5.7 cents a liter gas tax cut. I mean, I would imagine that that is going to play into their political stuff, because they're all over the carbon tax that is kicking in a week. So I don't know how temporary that's going to be, but that's something that I guess is popular, Anthony.
Well, they'll have 1 week to toot their horn before the federal carbon tax kicks in and pretty much eliminates that continued discount. So I don't think we'll see much of a change at the pumps that Doug Ford could take credit for, because Justin Trudeau's carbon tax comes in on its heels, and everyone else's the price of the pump will be going up. And despite Doug Ford saying, "I'm saving you 5 cents a liter,"
well, yeah, except I'm sure that they will find a way to trumpet that. Bill, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, it's true that with our CARP members, taxes and rising costs is a huge issue with them. And what they're looking for is a balance of new programs, but also looking carefully at programs that aren't as necessary anymore. And this is a good example of a conundrum. Most of our members, when we ask them, say that they want to leave the planet in better shape for their grandchildren than it is now. By the same token, they just can't afford to have the increases and the unexplained benefits that they're getting by paying higher taxes. And this is the biggest problem that the federal government has, and even the Ford government has, in explaining this whole tax structure. How is this really going to help the environment in the long run?
John, let's talk about this auto insurance thing, which, according to everything I've read, seems to actually be happening. So on the one hand, we have this huge crisis with carjacking. It has increased everyone's insurance bill. Obviously, the people who have the cars that are desirable, well, they have the biggest increases, and they have to install things if they want to involve to avoid massive increases. But what do you make of this move? I mean, there are companies, especially in the States, that have this. I don't know. It worries me. Is this on people's radar?
Well, certainly it's been a long-term commitment, as you know, by many governments to try and get insurance costs down. And so what the Ford government appears to be doing is, you know, almost giving you options to tailor make your own insurance. What that can lead to, of course, is opting out of things, which at the end of the day may cost you far more if you weren't covered. But nonetheless, they're giving you options to opt out of certain payments. You know, if it's by no fault and you don't want to pay for the damages on your car, I mean, you could probably opt out of that. But who knows, if it's worth tens of thousands of dollars, you may not get any money for that. So it means that you're going to have to be more careful in how you select what you're going to do. And there will be some people that go through it with a fine-tooth comb and make up their risk category. So you'll be able to do that. In terms of other parts of it, though, there doesn't seem to be much there that's going to reduce, you know, what we've seen. Number one is that, depending upon where you live, you know, you can get a certain amount, which is a premium in parts of the province or parts of the city that are different than others, and rightly so. That's because of the risk element. But in terms of having to pay more for stolen cars, I mean, other than the $18 million that the government has set forward so far to try and have heightened police activities and to try and go after those who are stealing it, there's nothing here that would help you along. So I guess I read this as more of a continuation of governments that are trying to say to consumers, you've got some choices here. You can lower your rates, but you know, caveat emptor. I mean, the risk is there if you choose, but nonetheless, you have the choice.
Well, yeah, and this already started because there was something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but a couple of years ago, there was one element, which I think was necessary, which suddenly became optional. And this is, Anthony, in the States, and you know those silly commercials, Liberty Bibberty, only pay for what you need, and it's. I mean, you know, when I look at it, it's what you need if nothing happens.
I think it's another version of shrinkflation. You get less and you're paying the same, or maybe you're paying a little bit less, but you're getting less. So if the insurance companies are now allowed to offer these things because it's so highly regulated, you'll be paying less, but you'll get less coverage. They're not going to decrease their costs or their revenue if they don't have to. And the consumer is going to be on the hook for the costs either in protection if there are lawsuits or protection of their material of their vehicles if they're damaged.
Well, yeah, and you're saying, well, they'll pay a little less. They might be paying more. I mean, when you, it's like with the carbon tax where in a week from now, the federal increases are going to obliterate the provincial decreases. I'm moving my hands here. Yeah. This one is the premium because of all this car theft, you know, may obliterate this so-called optionality. Bill, is that something on your radar?
Well, it certainly is because, you know, we all know that insurance rates are based on actuarial studies that show total costs and then divide up the premiums appropriately as the companies see fit. And in this case, we're worried that some segments of the population, and this could very well be very young drivers and much older drivers, could be hit by increases to balance off the benefits to the middle portion of the population. It doesn't necessarily mean lower rates for everyone. It might mean lower rates for a good number of the population.
Well, exactly. Do you see, John, anything on the list of CARP priorities that Bill told us about, which mostly have to do with healthcare? Do you see anything that would kind of fit with the tone of what we're expecting in the budget, which is making them at least appear that they're dealing with the affordability issues?
Well, look, there's usually three things that you look for in budgets. Number one is, you know, what kind of a statement is it about the fiscal wherewithal of the government and how it's going to meet its obligations? What the government's telegraphing to us is that deficit that it has and it's running is a result of, you know, economic conditions and downturns. We also, however, know that the government is now on the hook for some court rulings where it's going to have to pony up and, you know, spend an awful lot of money on back wages and things like that. So, I mean, there's a telegraphing going on here that, yes, there is revenue which is depleted because people don't have as much money. But secondly, we don't have the money because of a whole bunch of other things. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they're going to put in the window those things which are about affordability. So, you know, they're going to go into this budget. There's a great phrase about making a speech. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them and sit down. The government, in fact, is going to tell people what they're going to tell them. They're going to tell them, and then they're going to go out and sell it. And so insurance policies and those sort of things look like the cornerstone of this. But the third part is going to be about the general context and the priorities of the government, which will include healthcare and things like highways, which I'll bet you're going to hear an awful lot of advertisements suddenly, you know, peak up over the next week or so on things like that, because it will say that the government is spending this money on those things. But you and I know that it's not new money. It's usually old money that's being pulled forward. So I think healthcare will be kind of lost in parts of that. They'll say that they are getting money from the federal government. They are priorities, but it's not necessarily the things that they are going to be spending new money on. Probably, you know, it's old money, but put in the mix of the soup that they're going to serve up.
I'm going to give the numbers out again, people. I'd like to hear from you and see what you think. Do you think you will be better off after tomorrow afternoon because of the budget? And what do you think of the idea of being able to pick and choose the kind of auto coverage that you have? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740 for 740. And it does seem to be there is a bit of a driving theme here. There's auto insurance, there's a gas tax cut. And we just learned on Friday that the province can go ahead and build this Highway 413 without an environmental assessment. So I think there's a little package there.
Mm-hmm. The automotive thing I'm hearing most about amongst my peers in my community is the car thefts.
Yeah, well.
The $1 billion of losses every year. Everyone knows someone who's had their car stolen. Apparently, I just had a friend on Facebook this morning who had a car stolen from their driveway, and they found it around the corner in a neighbor's garage.
What?
Yeah, so the it was a local theft. So
what? Yeah. A neighbor had the nerve to... Oh, my goodness.
So
okay,
the police are investigating that right now. But the very flaccid response from government and police to solving these crimes, I think people are reacting to that. $18 million to solve a $1 billion problem doesn't seem like they're taking it seriously. And while the insurance companies are passing those costs on to the rest of us, I think we're getting to a bit of a breaking point there.
Well, we also saw some arrests in Montreal, and it's kind of like, duh, there's a problem at the port, and probably it involves people who work there. So maybe they're starting to get a handle on that. And John, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the cost of that settlement. So on the one hand, the Ford government was adamant that they couldn't raise wages more than 1% for the public sector. So they now have this huge bill. And on the other, we're finding out $1 billion for agency nurses. Is this ideological or is it just poor management?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm a bit baffled by it all. We don't really see the or hear from the health minister very often. I mean, when she was the attorney general, especially during the pandemic, the minister was rarely heard from. And the last time I think she was heard from, she was quite defensive over certain things, and that kind of made the headlines.
She's always defensive. Sorry to interrupt. Always.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it's true. So I mean, on the one hand, this, I think, is concerning to anybody that if you start out with an amount of money that was in the public sector that you were paying a certain amount for, and now you're running into billions, which is three times the amount somebody would be paid to go into and do the job that they were doing before, you know that there's an incentive to get out of the public service and into those roles. And secondly, it just seems to be an uncapped circumstance. So I don't understand it. It seems to be that, you know, in a budget, you can be addressing all the, you know, the nutrition that you hope a patient's going to have. But at the other end, they're bleeding profusely from every other artery in their body. So I don't know where this is coming from. And I'm not really sure, you know, where it's going to head. But man, is it ever an awful lot of money from the system? And it's, I don't think if you want to spend that much money, it's ideological.
Bill, is this something that's on the radar of CARP members?
Well, not necessarily CARP members, but certainly CARP has been looking at this closely. And it is, you know, it's difficult to examine exactly what happened. There has been great pressure on the government to supply nursing care right across the province and sometimes in rural areas where it just haven't been available. So it may be, and I'm just saying maybe, understandable that they would pay more, that they would have nurses and other medical professionals who would move into communities. So it would be more expensive to move them in and out and to pay them. And that may be a justified cost because otherwise there wouldn't be health care available in the community. On the other hand, did it get out of control? Were they just allowing all of it so that there was no pressure on them? And what was being charged could be appropriate given that the way that it's being delivered, but may not be necessary. So is it that it's individually too expensive, or was cost control just thrown to the wind when they tried to deal with these emergencies?
Anthony?
Well, I'm shocked that a nurse or a PSW would want to leave a unionized, protected environment to go work for an agency where they don't have those types of protections or those benefits. But if the dollars are such an increase, it's a 63% increase in the salaries, if that's the incentive to move out of the hospital environment, I'm surprised that they would do that, and perhaps that's a union issue as well.
Well, I think that possibly part of it is that they have more control of their schedules, because I think once you add in the benefits, that would probably be, I would think, around 50%, because those benefits are really good. And not to mention, those people get pensions that nobody else gets. I won't say nobody else gets, but public sector pensions are still there and private sector pensions are really not. So it might be the control of the schedules and people being burnt out, but it is a huge number. And, you know, it's one thing, in the pandemic it was very hard to get people, but, you know, when you look at it now and you're also looking at all this money being paid out, it just seems completely out of control.
And it could be a blip, as Doug Ford and the government have promised to increase that contingent of nurses that are coming into and onto stream right now. And you can see them coming. There's been tens of thousands coming out of the Ontario college systems. So that may be a blip in the radar as we have more nurses coming online and they do fill those jobs in hospitals.
Well, yeah. But on the other hand, a lot of very important jobs are not being filled, like family doctors. We got the numbers on matching. When they're ready for their residencies, they put their choices, and then they get offers. And 108, and they're very coveted, these spots, hard to get. Mm-hmm. 180 spots for family medicine residents unfilled in Ontario. And that is, it's much higher than last year. And it's really not a good thing. John, I think that is on people's radar.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, again, we're moving into an area that's going to become far more prominent. We talked about this, I think it was either last week or the week before, that the growing aging population is going to ramp up very significantly over the next few years. And so unless, you know, this is where the government itself gets into a circumstance where it's actually claiming that beds are dwellings, which is ridiculous. But it's starting to come on top of us, and we're starting to become more aware of this, and we're going to have more family members and others who are going to be involved in this sort of thing. So it is something that's worrisome. I don't know what you do if there's not enough places to send people, but arbitrarily sending people to places where, you know, they may not want to go is going to become a potential rise in the population.
Yep.
2.3 million Ontarians today don't have a family doctor. In 2 years, the OMA says it'll be 4.4 million. So that's the numbers John's talking about. The numbers of seniors are growing. They'll be greater need, and there's no plan in place to solve that crisis. Mm-hmm. It's a crisis.
Well, it's been coming, and we've been knowing about it for, what, a decade?
Well, we've been knowing about it since those baby boomers were born.
Exactly.
It's been about 70 years.
So the first time I made a speech on this, I was actually at the Empire Club. Do you know what year it was? 2003.
That was a while ago.
Yeah, it was when I was just a wee lad. The reality is that there doesn't seem to be any overarching planning of all of this. I also looked with a bit of dismay this past weekend because the Ontario Medical Association said that there's, I think, 110 spots for doctors which are still available that have not been claimed for residents in this latest round. You know, we hear more and more. We even have neighbors who have their kids who are studying to be doctors in Ireland and in England, and they can't get back in to get qualified on residency programs. So something is broken in the system. It just doesn't seem to be coordinated in any way. But as I said, back in 2003, you can draw a linear line. You can draw a line right through the demographics. You know exactly where this is heading. And I swear we're going to come up against it in the next 5 years where governments are suddenly going to look up and say, oh, my goodness, what's this all about? When in fact, it's been pre-warned for a long time.
Oh, a long time. And on a personal note, very happy we're getting a doctor in the family, our nephew's fiance. But she just got a residency in the United States. So and she wants to come back here eventually, but it's not that easy to come back here. So really, she was a great student. She studied elsewhere because she couldn't get a spot here. And now, you know, it's not guaranteed. And she's a great young doctor, or in a month or two anyway.
Well, the Ontario government seems to have, maybe perhaps with the Doctors Association, throttled the number of spaces for prospective students. And that is coming home to roost today, and it will continue because you can't just turn on medical students overnight and have thousands of doctors flooding into your system.
Well, yeah, that's right. Okay, well, we'll see what actually materializes in the budget. On that note, I am going to take one call before we wrap things up. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, very quickly. The topic about the doctors, I heard this morning that in Canada that the doctors are complaining about certain things that the naturopaths want to take on, like vaccines and a few other things they mentioned.
Oh, I thought naturopaths, most of them don't believe in vaccines. So I don't see.
Well, I don't know what it was. It was something about that they were saying that the naturopaths weren't fully trained. Well, I don't know about that.
Okay, well, they don't go to medical school. They go to the naturopaths were saying they could step in. I'm going to talk about this with our medical panel for the doctor shortage. I don't think so. I know a lot of people swear by naturopaths. As you can tell, I don't.
The pharmacists, the RPNs, other trained medical professionals waiting and in the wings to be asked to do more.
Okay, well, yeah, and some of them are already doing more, and that's good, but not naturopaths. Okay, I'm going to get nasty calls from naturopaths. All right. Thank you so much, Anthony Quinn, John Wright, and Bill Van Gorder. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Libby.
We're taking a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Kate, the Princess of Wales, disclosing her cancer diagnosis. We're going to be talking with Suzanne Boyd, the editor-in-chief and publisher of Zoomer Magazine and everythingzoomer.com when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment.
Well, that, of course, is Catherine, Princess of Wales, disclosing that she has cancer. She released the video Friday, about 2 months after her surgery, and an appalling amount of speculation and conspiracy theories around her condition. There's been a huge outpouring of sympathy around the world, which I share. And just imagine a young woman with young children who is constantly in the public eye. It's an awful situation for her. But I can't forget that we were told very emphatically that it was not cancer. And frankly, that statement would have been misleading at best. I expect people to be annoyed with me for saying that. So I'll give you the numbers to call. And 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'd like to go to someone who always has fascinating insights into all things royal, Suzanne Boyd, editor-in-chief and publisher of Zoomer Magazine and everythingzoomer.com. Suzanne, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Libby. And like you, I share the shock and sympathy towards Kate and the diagnosis. But I have a question for you based on what you just said.
Yeah.
Do we not take them at their word? And I think what she also alluded to or said in the statement that when after the surgery, they believed there was no cancer, but it was a test after the surgery, like a month after, that then revealed the cancer. So they, when they gave us that statement that it was not cancer, that was their knowledge and belief?
Not exactly. So okay. The way it would have been, if she said she had major surgery, mm-hmm. you can expect that it was some kind of growth. They would have done imaging. And mm-hmm. if they didn't see anything, what they would have said was, we don't see any cancer. That's great. But we won't really know till we open you up.
Oh, so, okay. So I see your point.
Right. and it's sometimes they open somebody up and they see and they see a lot more than they've seen on the imaging. So mm-hmm. thank goodness that apparently was not the case. So they said they might have said, and again, conjecture, they might have said, you know, great, we didn't see anything, but it could be microscopic and it was sent to the pathology lab. And as I said, if you're Libby in Toronto, that takes 2 or 3 weeks because pathology is backed up here. If you're Catherine, Princess of Wales, I'm not sure exactly, but it's, you know, maybe a week or two. And I would have thought that there would, and I've heard other doctors, everybody's trying to be really diplomatic, say there would have been probably some kind of suspicion when she was getting this checked out. I think it's quite different than what happened to the King, where he went in for a very common procedure, and it sounds like they actually saw it there.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Thanks for breaking that down, because I don't have that as much knowledge on the medical side as you do and would. So I just thought it made sense to me. Oh, they went in and they did the surgery, and then they did some tests of whatever they took out, and then they realized it was cancer. So, but I guess I'm just speculating again.
Well, we're all speculating, but what do you think this does? I mean, the PR around this has mm-hmm. been, you know, dismal.
Yeah, I think that's really the issue, and it's something that we go back and forth on with the monarchy, this idea of transparency versus privacy, this vision of, you know, their aspirational family, you have to look up to them. So they're real, but they can't be too real. And they're on the public purse. So what do they owe us in terms of information, the British public and people in the Commonwealth who are supposedly the subjects? So it's just the PR from the beginning to the end has just been a boondoggle. I mean, the confluence of events around the King's health at the same time, Kate's health, the fact that, you know, I just go back to the Queen so often on these things where she said, you know, she acted, never complain, never explain. Now they have to explain. And she also said, I have to be seen to be believed. And, you know, this was the issue. One of the most followed, thought about prominent women in the world disappears. And she says she's disappearing. But then these conspiracy theories start online. And then the photo, I think the photo just made everything explode. And then it really forced them to change course and I think led to her having to make the statement, which I think was a positive thing that she did eventually make it in the end.
What do you think this means? I mean, you know, the Queen had her way of dealing with it, but she didn't have social media to deal with.
Well, yes, and not till the end. But, those tabloid fires that she dealt with in the 90s and, you know, around the death of Diana, yeah. where I almost felt where you have to say something, where, you know, when they stayed up at the castle with the boys after Diana died and she didn't come down from Windsor to Buckingham Palace, and the people said, you have to say something. And I felt it was very much that situation for the royal family, but it was happening on social media instead of people outside the palace, literally at the gates of the palace, shouting, holding up signs, you know. So this was social, it was happening on social media for Kate. And it felt that she, it really was the respect and the belief in the institution, and that she really had to come forward. I think it was that much of an issue after the PR fail of the photo. And so that's why the statement was necessary. And I think, you know, there, you know, the royal family has been this through before when they did that documentary in 1969, where the first time they exposed like their family life to the world, and then it was banned, and for years and years and years, and then it's this documentary has popped up on social media, and they did put a copyright ban on it, and it's still up on social media. So you can't really fight with social media, but you have to be able to try and manage it. I mean, this video of Kate, there's some people saying that it's AI.
Oh, I heard that. Oh, come on.
Nothing will please. And so I even, you know, being, you know, going down the rabbit hole, I sort of went into my phone, you know, enlarged the video. And yes, the mole is there. It's, she's just in bright sunlight, surrounded by beautiful daffodils as a sign, I guess, of support for other, you know, cancer patients, as she said at the end, and it is her, but the conspiracies will never stop.
Yeah, and there were some euphemisms. I mean, you know, I just think that it's not helpful for people going through cancer to sort of fudge a lot of stuff. So she called it preventive chemotherapy. You know, what's all chemotherapy is preventive. It is trying to prevent growth and spread. And in her case, it's trying to prevent spread. So to call it preventive, you know, it's not preventing the cancer. The cancer is there. And I've even seen British doctors interviewed and they say, oh, well, there's another word for it, you know, adjuvant chemotherapy. But I think that I think her words were probably chosen very carefully, but I don't think it's good to fudge this stuff. I mean, and people are already extrapolating. She's going to be such an amazing advocate after this. Well, we don't really know that.
But okay, so again, I took it differently, maybe not being, you know, that I thought it was, oh, so whatever she had was cancerous, it's removed, and now they're treating it to prevent it. I just took it at face value.
Yeah, they might not know. I mean, if there were still, they would have found whether there were cancer cells in the sample, right? So
right.
They would have found cancer cells, which means that there could, maybe yes and maybe no, still be cancer cells in her body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they gave her treatment. So, you know, for instance, I don't want to talk about me, but I had a big tumor with a lot of treatment, and there was still a little left, and they sent it to pathology, and there were no cancer cells there. So I didn't have to do any more treatment. I mean, I don't know what kind she has, but it's just, you know, this is a process, and it actually generally takes quite a while, certainly here, before you get a definitive view. It's possible, again, that, you know, that she didn't until the pathology was back. But, you know, I just think that people should know that it's kind of a long and very distressing process before a cancer is diagnosed, or it can be long. So, you know, I don't know.
So maybe she didn't know until they said it.
Well, and you know, people hear different things. If they said, we don't think it's cancer, or we hope it's not cancer, that's could very well be exactly what she heard, and she probably might have had people saying that to her. Don't worry, it won't be. But again, so what right to privacy does she have?
Well, this is it. And I think because she is that, I think that's the question. She is, will be the future queen. She is supported by, you know, the public purse in, you know, and actually just by chance, we have King Charles on the cover of the next issue of Zoomer magazine to celebrate the, to mark the first anniversary of coronation. And there is a story about, of course, we went to press before this story about Kate broke. And because it's also a finance issue, we talk about how royals are, you know, supported and what are the different mechanisms in England through which they're supported and what's their private wealth or the public wealth. So she's not the head of state. She's not the constitutional monarch. I don't think there is as much a right to know as there is for King Charles. But people may disagree on that because she is supported by the public person. She is, many people believe she is, you know, her husband is first in line to the throne. She will be the next queen. And many people believe that she is one of the people in the slimmed down monarchy that's keeping it afloat. That if she wasn't a part of the family, the British public would feel much differently about it. And she's, no pun intended, the jewel in the crown of, yeah, of the royal family. So I think that's why it was so important that she had to come out and speak, because of the speculation that led around her marriage and the gossip around her marriage that was picked up by mainstream American media.
I was surprised by that. Like, just opening, you know, a mainstream newspaper and they said, oh, well, you know, it looks like her husband is having an affair. I mean, I was shocked by that.
Yeah, and they named the woman, too, yeah, the supposed person. And, you know, Prince William has taken legal action about that several years ago. And apparently this woman whose husband is part of the court actually has sent a legal letter to the Stephen Colbert show. He was the one who really sort of literally broadcast it on his show as a joke. And, you know, and so I think she really just had to come forward and say something. And you know, I think it also, it was very noteworthy in the speech, she mentioned how having William at her side, and she was wearing the engagement, her wedding rings, which she hadn't been in the doctored photo. So, yeah, I think she really just had to come forward and say something, less so about her health, but about just this idea of the conspiracy theories. Where is she? Are they? Is their marriage okay? And how important all that is to quell that down is to the future of the family, while the king is not as front-facing as he is because he is undergoing cancer treatment.
Well, before I let you go, Suzanne, I'd just like to ask, sort of compare and contrast the way this came out for the king, mm-hmm, and what happened with her while she was trying harder to not to disclose.
Well, I think, you know, the cover-up is always worse, and I think the photo was the problem. I think, again, the king being the constitutional monarch, the head of state, had to be more forthcoming, and he did promise that he would have a formal, informal, more transparent reign than his mother's reign, because we know royals have had health problems. No one knew that George VI had cancer. You know, no one knew the queen had blood cancer until after she died. So it's, you know, he was so forthcoming. With her, I do think it's a bit different because, again, she's not the constitutional monarch. But what it shows is that in the older days, there was one palace structure of PR and communications. It all came from Buckingham Palace and all the other, Clarence House at the time, which when he was Prince Charles, Kensington Palace, which is William, and then Prince Harry when he was still in the royal family, working royal family fold. It all came from one place, but then all those PR operations were separated out. And, you know, so they're not speaking as one. So Kensington Palace has one way, which is Kate and William, as opposed to Buckingham Palace, which is the king's. They have different comms and different approaches. And there's also the Prince William factor, who is deeply, deeply private and does not like the media because of how they treated his mother, and has an aversion to sharing a lot and being as open as perhaps his father is. So I think all those together has made it different. But as we saw, her coming forward was a step in the right direction in terms of people understanding, and probably she will now get the privacy she wants, and I believe she deserves.
Okay, Suzanne, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Libby.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we are taking another break. When we come back, the latest on Ukraine and that horrible terrorist attack that ISIS-K claimed responsibility for.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. As you heard in our noon news, the four suspects in the Crocus Concert Hall attack all have appeared in court and been charged with committing a terrorist act. The death toll is now up to 137. ISIS, specifically ISIS-K, has released a gruesome video, but Putin's disinformation campaign seems to be well underway. I think a headline in The Economist put it best. It said, Putin has begun Operation Blame Ukraine, and he's stepped up the military campaign as well. What do you think of the situation? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Dr. Maria Popova, Associate Professor of Political Science at McGill, and Dr. Andrei Zayarnyuk, Professor of History at the University of Winnipeg. Thanks so much for being with us. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you.
Let's begin with Dr. Zayarnyuk. Does this attempt by Putin to kind of shift the blame, does that surprise you?
No, not really. And we should wait and see what Russia says after they finish their investigation. So far, there was just an indication in Putin's speech, and of course, many Russian pundits rushed to blame Ukraine, but let's wait and see what would be the official verdict.
Dr. Popova, one thing, the U.S., had credible intelligence about this, which they passed on to Moscow. So what does the fact that it took place, I mean, how important is that fact, and do Russians know it?
Well, Russians do know it because Putin actually went on TV after he received this U.S. intelligence and accused the U.S. of trying to destabilize Russia. You would think that right now he has egg on his face, but he never feels this way and never apologizes for anything. In every crisis, he first hides for about 24 hours and then comes up with an explanation that tries to shift the blame away from his government, which in this case basically has completely mismanaged the situation. They got this warning and they didn't do anything about it.
Dr. Zayarnyuk, do you agree they mismanaged the situation?
Well, yes, there is plenty of information about police actually being on the scene of the attack and basically just running away. Also, with the fire in the building, the way special forces behaved. I mean, what we saw was basically just a show of brutality, you know, the cut ears, tortured suspects, but no efficiency. And yes, they ignored the warning. They officially announced that, you know, it's a disinformation by the West. So, yeah, Russian special services, Russian government showed very poor performance in all of this.
Dr. Popova, Putin's thing is that he is on top of security. He will protect Russia and the Russian people. So how bad is this for him? And do you think there might be any consequence?
You know, of course, it is bad in the sense that he has shown his government to not be actually competent in assuring security. But I think we need to remember that this has happened many times in Russia before, during his 24 years in power. This is not the first terrorist attack. Unfortunately, not even the worst one in terms of death toll. But he is unlikely to be really punished by Russian society, by the electorate. That's just really not how Russia works. We tend to think of situations like this through our own lens, which is sort of, you know, if the government does a really poor job, we vote against it, or, you know, we organize against it. And in fact, in Russia, we haven't seen, even though there have been plenty of terrorist attacks over the years, we haven't seen really major mobilization and major blame directed towards Putin. The blame is likely going to be directed at lower level management.
Okay, I'm going to take a very quick call from Melanie in High Park. Hello, Melanie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'll make it quick. As of Ukrainian, Russian, Polish, Jewish heritage, I'll tell you one thing. Russia has done this for 600 years, the Potemkin village under Catherine the Great. Russia has an arrogance problem. They have it even here. I have Russian people telling me, oh, Putin Rossiya buduye, he's building Russia. And I said, what, with the rotting corpses of Russian men and women and Ukrainian men and women? The only thing he's growing is worms in the ground.
Okay.
But this is happening for 600 years, but the people are intimidated. I understand.
Okay, thank you for that, Melanie. All right. We're starting to run out of time. Dr. Zayarnyuk, what happens next?
Well, the same thing we've seen for the last 2 years. You know, every day Russia will kill hundreds, actually, on the front line. I mean, we are drawn to this terrorist attack because it happened in Moscow, you know, far away from the front line. But the thing to remember is that we have 150 people killed on a good day and twice as many on a bad day. And it's been going on for 2 years, so nothing changed. The terrorist attack in Moscow did not actually interrupt Russian attacks against Ukrainian cities. There was not even a pause there. So I don't see how this will change anything.
And Dr. Popova, finally, what can you tell us about ISIS-K?
Well, they've taken responsibility for this. There have been Islamist terrorist attacks in Russia before. It makes sense given Russia's role in suppressing, in helping the Assad government in his fight against ISIS. So it's highly likely that this is indeed an ISIS operation, and that they will continue seeing Russia as an enemy.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Dr. Maria Popova, Dr. Andrei Zayarnyuk. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.